welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 111. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around I've decided to throw in an extra episode and do a music podcast and have a bit of a groove, listen to some tunes, and take it easy and just be mellow. Now, the reason I'm doing this is I'm actually off sick from work at the moment. I have gastroenteritis for a few days. So I thought I'd use the time to lay down some tracks, get some music happening here, and just enjoy myself and share a little bit of what I've been listening to with you guys as an audience. So that's about it. That's what I'm going to be doing, and that's what I'm going to be enjoying. Okay, so I've got some news. The radio gig, the ABC local radio in Darwin gig, Films with Frost, that I was doing with Ivor Cole for a few years, has ended. Ivor wanted to keep me on. The people up in Darwin like what I'm doing, but they've decided that the station has too many bits of movie stuff, so they're kind of rolling me into the afternoon show, and I'm going to be doing occasional bits with the afternoon presenter, whose name is Richard Margetson, and doing that. It's not going to be the same. It's not going to be as frequent as it was, which is okay. I'm a little bit sad about not being able to chat with Ivor every week about movies, but that's the nature of the business. They've got new management at the station, and I kind of accept that, and I'm staying professional. I'd prefer to keep chatting with Ivor forever, which isn't to say that we're not going to do that in future, but it's a little bit of a bummer, but I'm going later this afternoon. I'm dragging myself from my sick bed, heading into town, going down to South Bank, and I'm going to be recording a little bit of a talk with Richard regarding Woody Allen. So I'm brushing up on my Woody Allen a little bit, and we're going to do that. So, yeah, things change, and we have to accept that. I really loved this time I've spent chatting with Ivor, but that's the nature of it, and unfortunately, it can't continue. Having said that, let's play some music. Let me just have a look at what track I'm going to play first, because I'm playing this totally by ear. I'm freestyling this whole podcast. As some of you might know, I've got this real passion for actors who aren't normally known to be singers singing in movies. I find it hilarious some of the time. Some of the time it's surprisingly good, but most of the time it isn't. This one's from a really weird little film, which is very, very hard to find. I've only ever found a really bad VHS dub of the film. It's from 1969. It's called Can Hieronymus Merkin Ever Forget Mercy Hump and Find True Happiness? Which was kind of like Anthony Newley's attempt to do a Fellini movie. Not really successful. It did have some nudity in it, which of course is always a saving grace with films that aren't very good. But it also has Anthony Newley's then-wife, Joan Collins, singing in it. Now, Joan Collins isn't known for singing, and there is actually a very valid reason for that. She's not very good at it. Having said that, there's a song in there that I kind of like her singing in, called Chalk and Cheese. I may have played it before on the podcast. I'm not sure. It would have been a fair while back if I have. But I thought I'd just inflict it on you and let you decide for yourself about Joan Collins' success or otherwise of singing. So here it is, Chalk and Cheese, from Can Hieronymus Merkin Ever Forget Mercy Hump and Find True Happiness, one of the great bad titles of cinema history. And it's Joan Collins singing Chalk and Cheese.
How did you get into my horoscope? You funny, irascible, lovable dope. Isn't it clear from the stars that you haven't a hope with me? Anyone else would have known in advance. Libra and Gemini haven't a chance. Anyone else would have seen at a glance it could never. Chalk and cheese, we're as different as chalk and cheese. Were there ever two people more at a step before? More unlike, if you please. Souls apart, we are opposite poles apart. When I think about me and you, saying, how'd you do? Maybe it wasn't so smart. Me, I'm bright, got a groovy scene. I like to be where it's at. You're uptight as a tambourine. What kind of music is that? Chalk and cheese. Who would ever blend things like these? On the other hand, people say love is here to stay. Hooray for the birds and the bees. For you speak to me and my legs go weak at the knees. I'm a fool, maybe, but I don't mind chalk with my cheese.
Sorry about the sound quality on that. It's not the best, but it came from an old album. I always like songs where people say things like groovy scene and where it's at. You got to kind of like that 1970s conceit, or 1960s, 1970s conceit of those kind of things. It's interesting how language in pop culture has evolved over the years, but I kind of like where it's at as a concept. You know, you can tell people that that's where it's at, or this is where it's at. And I do enjoy that conceptually. Now we're going to move on to a band from Spain in the 1960s who sang in English, not particularly well, but they did sing in English. They're called Los Bravos, and they did a movie which was never released in English. They were kind of a beat group formed in 1965 and based in Madrid, and the lead singer was German, believe it or not. And apparently he's been compared to Gene Pitney. But I kind of like Los Bravos. They did a movie called, let me just work this out because I'm not up on my Spanish as much as I should be. It's called Los Chicos con Las Chicas. And there's one really good song in that movie that I enjoy a lot called Going Nowhere. And it's very much dead center of early 1960s pop music. It's from about 1965, 1966, but I do enjoy it a lot. I think it's got that perfect vibe for the time and place and the kind of beat pop music of the mid-1960s. So I'll just play that now. It's called Going Nowhere, and it's really addictive.
Do another thing today, gonna teach myself to laugh. If I never do another thing today, gonna try to learn to cry. I've got to live my life my way. Feel every feeling today. Got no time to waste. I proceed with haste, watching everybody going over. Say that I am crazy. All the little people with the little mites gonna say, best boy, yes, man. What should I plan for the future? Let the future make things for me. Got no time.
In the 1960s in the UK, and late 1960s and early 1970s, in fact, there were a lot of really cool action-adventure TV shows happening. There was Department S and the spin-off Jason King. You had The Prisoner, of course, would have probably been the first one of those. You had The Adventurer with Gene Barry. You had The Champions. You had The Professionals later on in the 1970s. And all of them had a few things in common, one of which is they were very cool. The rest were they had fantastic music to them. Now, there's one that was done by Gerry Anderson, who died in the last couple of weeks, the guy who did the Thunderbirds and Fireball, XL5 and all those kind of TV shows. And for me, it's a kind of failed but really cool attempt at this kind of format. It failed mostly because of one thing. It was a half-hour format for an action-adventure TV show. Now, these things usually run about an hour. An hour is about the perfect length for an action-adventure TV show. For some reason, Gerry Anderson decides to go half an hour, which I believe was a big mistake. So he did a TV series called The Protectors, which starred Robert Vaughan, a New Zealand actress called Norrie Dawn Porter, who was very sexy, and a guy called Tony Anholt, who really rocked the cravat and things like that. So they were basically a bunch of freelance international private detectives who were at the top end of the market, travelled around Europe. There were a lot of European location shoots and things like that, and basically solved crimes with the usual bunch of character actors playing the bad guys. Now, the coolest thing in some ways about The Protectors was the theme song. It was done by a guy whose original name was Anthony Fitzgerald, but who people knew as Tony Christie. Really strong tenor voice. And he always put a little bit of vibrato in there. It's a very European thing to have a vibrato in a male singing voice. But he did it, and his theme song for The Protectors, Avenues and Alleyways, has attained cult status beyond the cult status of the TV show. So I'm going to play it now, but it is very cool, and the orchestrations just work, and it's perfect moment in time of the British TV adventure film, and I think it's the most iconic song from any of those.
Baby, my little lady, dream till the sunrise creeps into your eyes, dream till the sunrise.
I kind of like the blues, and I do like the fact that there's a certain kind of the blues that's really transgressive and sexual and open about the interests that a lot of men have in women and a lot of women have in men. And I found a really cool track that I like by one of the old classic blues shouters, a guy called Winoni Harris. Now, the track, which is, yeah, transgressive, is called Sitting On It All The Time. And I do kind of like it. Politically correct, it's not, but it's got a certain honesty about it. And it is kind of cool. It's not going to be for everyone. It's not going to be something that some women I know like, but it is a part of history, and it's got a nice beat to it and a nice rhythm to it, and it does have a certain viewpoint. So here it is, Winoni Harris with Sitting On It All The Time.
Old maid, stop acting like a baby child. Old maid, stop acting like a baby child. Till you got 63 before you started running wild. Well, I'm looking for a gal, she's got to be young and neat. Well, I'm looking for a gal, she's got to be young and neat. What good is your stove if it don't give out no heat? Love and romance, but you let it pass you by. Cause when you was 10, you used to run from men.
Kept on sitting on it all the time.
When you were 15, you was a natural queen.
But you kept on sitting on it all the time.
When you was 22, you didn't know what to do. When you was 25, you thought about that child.
But you kept on sitting on it all the time. You kept on.
When you was 31, you was hot as the sun. You kept on sitting on it all the When you were 38, it still wasn't too late.
But you kept on sitting on it all the time. You kept on sitting on it all the time.
When you was 44, men were still knocking at your door.
You kept on sitting on it all the time.
When you was 49, you changed your mind. When you was 52, you still knew what to do.
But you kept on sitting on it all the time.
Keep on sitting on it all the time.
I like Mel Torme. I think he's a cool singer. I think that he's a good writer too. There are a couple of books of his written. One was a fictional book called Winner, W-Y-N-N-E-R, which is a kind of romantic play about life in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And he did write a book about being the musical director on a Judy Garland TV show that went west, both of which are really good reads. But I do like him as a singer as well, and this is one of my favourite ones. It's a more obscure Mel Torme song. It comes from an even more obscure movie from 1941 that starred Lupe Velez, Leon Errol, William Frawley and Shemp Howard, of all people. And that was called Six Lessons from Madame Lazonga, which the song is called. I'll read you the IMDb thing on this movie, which I haven't been able to get a decent copy of, unfortunately. The brash, opinionated owner of a nightclub manages to drive everyone crazy on a boat trip to Havana. That's all we've got on that. So if anyone's got a decent copy of the movie Six Lessons from Madame Lazonga, hook me up, okay? So this song is the theme song from Six Lessons from Madame Lazonga, sung by Mel Torme from his album from the late 1950s, South of the Border. There were a lot of people doing South of the Border style albums at the time.
Have you ever been embarrassed when you're in a smart cafe? When they play that Latin tempo, is your dancing quite passe? There's a studio on Main Street over Tony's clothing store, where a very small investment pays you dividends galore. Lessons from Madame Lozanga, and you'll be known from Maine to Cucamonga. Six lessons, and Madame will slick up your cha-cha and mambo, including the hiccup. Her four Latin daughters will help you to start. While finding the rhythm, you might lose your heart. Six lessons from Madame Lozanga, and you'll discover what practice can do. She'll give you the beat, give you two brand new feet. It's bound to bring out the Latin in you. Rosita gives you lesson one, Chiquita gives you lesson two. Madam's there to supervise every step and exercise. The madam shows you how to walk, the madam marks it with a chalk. When the madam starts to squawk, that's her Latin double talk. Six lessons from that gal Lozanga will positively do wonders for you. Get hip, get real cool, start your own dancing school. It's bound to bring out the Latin in you.
There weren't many women in the movie The Flight of the Phoenix, the first one, not the second one. In fact, there were only one and a bit women in the whole movie, one of which was an hallucination of a belly dancing girl. And the other one was a voice on the radio singing an Italian love song. That was Connie Francis. And the song she sang is Senza Fine, which is a really nice Italian love song. I mean, I'm really getting into Italian love songs at the moment for some reason. Don't speak Italian. I speak, like, pizza Italian. I can say marinara, I can say all of those kind of things, but nothing beyond that. Pesto, I can do pesto as well, but not terribly much Italian. But I kind of like them. It's a bit like French love songs for me. I don't mind that I can't understand the lyrics. I can look them up, but I get sucked up in the feel of the piece. And this one's mostly in English, but with a little bit of Italian stuff in it, which makes it even simpler for me, Senza Fine, by Connie Francis. But I do like it. I think any song with a mandolin in it has always got a bit of an advantage, that kind of mandolin sound in the background. But yeah, it's kind of cool, and it's very much at odds with the Darwinian real hard slog part of the movie. It's a softening of the film in the way it's used, which makes it kind of interesting. They've got all these starving, dying of thirst men trying to put together an aeroplane out of spare parts of a broken aeroplane. And this song kind of acts as a reminder of what they're away from and what they're trying to get back to, that gentleness and the rest of the world. So it kind of works in the context of the movie, and I do like it as a song. It's gentle, it's smooth, and it's my kind of stuff.
Sansofine, let it always be Sansofine. There's no end to our love, our hopes, our dreams, our sighs. No end at all, no sad goodbyes. No fears, no tears, no love that dies. It's Sansofine, let it always be Sansofine. Never ending the summer days, the moonlit nights, the sea, the sand, the starry heights are yours and mine forever.
Very cool guy. He broke through a lot of the color barriers in the States for a long time. He was the first black man to have a regular TV show on American television, and that in itself is an achievement. But he did tend to play it a little bit safe when it came to ethnicity, in a sense. There was probably more of the times than anything else, but he died just as the civil rights movement was coming along, and it would have been interesting to see whether he would have been a part of that had he lived a bit longer and had somebody not advised him to mellow his voice out by taking up smoking, which ultimately killed him. But I kind of like this one. I like the fact that most of the accompaniments are conga drum, and that kind of works. Just voice and conga drum together is a really interesting combination. And the track is Calypso Blues, which there are a whole bunch of different versions of it. But I do like Nat Cole's version, so I'm going to play that now.
Wow, 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 hey. Wow, 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 sitting by the ocean, me how she feels so sad. Sitting by the ocean, me how she feels so sad. Don't got the money to take me back to Trinidad. Fine Calypso woman, she cooked me shrimp and rice. Fine Calypso woman, she cooked me shrimp and rice. These Yankee hot dogs don't treat me stomach very nice. In Trinidad, $1 buy papaya juice, banana pie, 6 coconut, 1 female goat, and plenty fish to fill the boat.
one bushel bread, one barrel of wine, and all the town she comes to dine. But here is bad, $1 buy, cup of coffee, ham on rye. Me throat she's sick from necktie, me feet she hurt from shoes, me pocket full of empty, I got calypso blues. These Yankee girls give me big scare. Is black the root? Is blonde the hair? Her eyelash false, her face is paint, and pads are where the girl she ain't. She jitterbugs when she should waltz. I even think her name is false. But Calypso girl is good a lot, is what you see, is what she got. Sitting by the ocean, me how she feels so sad. Don't got the money to take me back to Trinidad. Wow, 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 wow. Wow, 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 wow. Wow, 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 wow. Wow, wow.
This next artist I had to look up on Wikipedia to find out anything at all about her. Her name is Sheila Geese, G-U-Y-S-E, and at the time, which was the 1940s, she was a kind of rival to Dorothy Dandridge in the black, beautiful female actress kind of realm. She did four movies, really, which were mostly for predominantly black audiences. Let's have a look. There was Boy, What a Girl, Sepia, Cinderella, Miracle in Harlem, Harlem Follies of 1949, and another movie, a TV movie called Green Pastures in 1957. So basically five things. But good singing voice. She was considered by a lot of people to be a better actress than Dorothy Dandridge. And she's one of those people that history's kind of folded over the page so you don't know anything about her. But I like her singing voice, and I like her cover version of Billie Holiday's I Cover the Waterfront, which I'm going to play for you now. Really interesting voice, really interesting woman, and she is a part of cinema history that we don't hear enough about, really, particularly here in Australia. Maybe a little more in the States, but over here we don't hear a lot about movies that were made strictly for black cinema in the 1940s in America. But here she is, Sheila Geese with I Cover the Waterfront.
I cover the waterfront. I'm watching the sea. Will the one I love be coming back? Must soon come back to me.
I do like that version of that. It's kind of from a slightly rarer singer than most of the versions I've heard. I've heard Billie Holiday's version. I've heard a few other versions, but I kind of like Sheila Geese's version. It's got something about it. But I'm going to take a break from doing music now and kind of do something that I wasn't going to do, and I kind of want some feedback on this. So it's a little bit out of the ordinary. Now, I'm putting together a kind of semi-secret project. I'm doing a book about movies, and I've written the introduction. Now, I want to know if I'm on the right track with this stuff, and I'm taking a chance and putting it out there for the podcast listeners to go at. I don't have any contracts or anybody who wants to buy the book or anything like that. I'm just doing this purely as an act of faith and because I need to do it. So I'm going to give you the introduction to the book, as yet unnamed. But it will have Paleo Cinema somewhere in the title because I'm going to keep my branding. So I'm going to give you that. The title I've got for the introduction at the moment, and this is silly, I fully acknowledge that, is A Subjective History of the Liberation of Cinema from Men in Suits. So here goes. I grew up in the 1960s and the 1970s. There are a lot of good things about those times. The music was good. There were still cars with fins on them. You could buy enough fish and chips to feed a family with pocket change. And nobody ever complained about not getting a Wi-Fi signal. But it wasn't all strawberry alarm clock, battered Savoy's and Chevy Impalas. For someone like me who would evolve, or some would say devolve, into a dedicated cinephile, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. This was an era before movie geeks as we know them existed. We were considered weird for spending our lunch hours at school arguing on who'd win a fight between Robbie the Robot and that nameless mechanical man from Lost in Space. Our relatives told us that we'd go blind from sitting too close to television sets. Later on, we'd be told that other pleasurable activities would somehow lead to a life of white canes and Labradors. But before puberty, the biggest threat to our ocular acuity was an episode of the Herculoids on Saturday morning television. What our parents and guardians didn't know was that the cheap suburban cinemas we were visiting on Saturday afternoons, drive-in double features we were taken to, and the movies shown on weekend televisions were the spawning ground for a new generation of film buffs. Just as our parents were monomaniacally interested in horse and greyhound racing and football and how to get beer on a Sunday, we were becoming eerily knowledgeable about genre films, the relative merits of concession stand snacks, and the security measures taken by picture palaces to keep out freeloaders. For my brother Gary and I, Saturday matinees at the Regal Theatre in Liverpool, New South Wales, were our babysitters. While my father attended nearby hotels, we were nurtured by Elvis musicals, Dean Martin as Matt Helm, James Coburn as Derek Flint, Carry On movies, Sword and Sandal peplum epics, caper films, and the kind of middle-aged wish fulfillment comedies that ended up bankrupting MGM in the 1960s. These films, good, bad, and indifferent, showed us the world. They taught us that imagination was a good thing, that there was nothing cooler than going to the movies without adult supervision, that a well-placed karate chop could take down any opponent, and that pool halls weren't the only places to misspend your youth. Although we didn't know it at the time, we were becoming movie geeks, a term which didn't exist until the punk era of VCRs in the 1980s. Geeks of any sort weren't fashionable before the 1980s. The very word geek meant something different back then. Check out Tyrone Power and Nightmare Alley for more details. Geeks were carnival freaks, usually terminal alcoholics, who dressed up as ape men and bit the heads off live chickens in sideshows. Reality television works on basically the same concept. As wonderful as Saturday matinees were, there were problems with being a nascent movie buff in those days. The now simple act of finding and seeing a specific movie was about as easy as visiting Brigadoon. You had to be in the right place at the right time and you had to be bloody lucky. The problem was that the delivery systems for movies were primitive. It was the middle of the 20th century and the closest thing you had to video on demand was a Scopitone jukebox. If you wanted to see a particular horror or science fiction movie in the dim, dark days of the 1960s, you had three possible times when it was available. Maybe. Those times were between midnight and dawn on a public holiday. late on a Saturday night or on New Year's Eve. That needs some explaining. Between midnight and dawn on a long weekend, television channels here would throw together three or four 1950s science fiction or horror movies they could get cheaply from distributors, and they'd show them. In a weird way, they were acts of faith, and the channels never knew how popular or unpopular these movie marathons were. Ratings didn't run that late at night. Working in this information vacuum, the channels didn't advertise the movie marathons. You had to buy a newspaper or a TV guide and check the listings, or be told by a friend that when they were on. My brother Gary and I loved movie marathons, but there were obstacles to us watching them. We were not unschooled in deviousness and guile. We'd seen The Caper of the Golden Bulls, They Came to Rob Las Vegas, and Top Carpy. We knew how to plan and execute a caper. So we snuck out of bed, turned the TV volume down low, and became familiar with the works of John Agar, Jack Arnold, Beverly Garland, and Richard Carlson. It was worth a half comatose Sunday to stay up all night and watch them, and then we could sneak back to bed before anyone was any the wiser. Your second possibility for viewing that one desired movie was late on a Saturday night. Stealing the concept of horror movies from the Americans, the O10 network showed double feature horror films hosted by a bunch of different guys called Deadly Earnest. Deadly Earnest were disgusting, ghoulish characters cracking badly punning jokes in a set decorated with coffins, spider webs, and instruments of medieval torture. Every kid who saw those shows wanted to decorate their bedrooms with funnel webs, funeral home furniture, and guillotines. Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, and Adelaide all had different Deadly Earnests. They all looked different, and they did individual shtick. Fortunately, interstate travel was less common in the 60s, so Deadly Earnest confusion among 7 to 14-year-old boys was kept manageable levels. I may be biased, but Sydney had the best Deadly Earnest. Ian Bannerman. He looked like Michael Caine as Harry Palmer as a zombie. He was that point where Beatlemania meets the undead, and it worked. None of the other Deadly Earnest approached his level of cool. The Deadly Earnest hosted and mocked movies like The Hypnotic Eye, It Came From Beneath the Sea, The Beast From 20,000 Fathoms, and The Monster of Piedras Blancas. Solid 1950s drive-in movies sold to television stations in cheap packages. Again, it required us to stay up past bedtime, but it wasn't a school night, so you could cut a deal if you were lucky. But if you wanted to see your cherished horror or science fiction movie in an actual cinema, you might get to see it once at one annual point in the space-time continuum. The Regal Theatre showed two back-to-back horror movies every New Year's Eve at midnight. The theatre managers were more marketing savvy than the television networks. They knew their audiences and acted accordingly. Lobby cards for the horror features were displayed 2 months before New Year's Eve in an alcove window outside the cinema. Every kid who went to a Saturday matinee saw the lobby cards and wanted to go to that one midnight session where The Creature from the Black Lagoon or Psycho or Kukuruku, The Beast of the Amazon or Kaltiki, The Immortal Monster would be shown. The lobby cards teased us with images of Anthony Perkins, The Gill Man and lesser rubber-suited monsters. We really wanted to go to those films. Logistically, getting to the midnight session was a nightmare beyond anything in the movies themselves. It required a parent or guardian to be somewhat sober and willing to drive you into town at 11:30 on New Year's Eve. But that was only half of it. They also had to be conscious, not in an emergency ward and out of jail at 4 a.m. on New Year's Day to pick you up. None of these conditions were ever certain in my family. I got to go to the midnight session exactly once. A responsible third party dropped Gary and I off and picked us up. I don't remember what we saw, but we enjoyed it. Now, we also had to contend with the ultimate cinematic cock blocker, the censors. In 1948, the Australian government censors banned all horror movies from cinemas. Not that 1948 was a particularly good year for horror movies, but for some reason they decided to protect hundreds of thousands of World War II veterans from seeing the horrors of Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi or Lon Chaney Jr. This policy continued for over a decade, which meant that by the 1960s and 1970s, there weren't many prints of classic horror films in Australia. But the censors were even dumber than that, just to give you an example. In the late 1940s, they also expressed grave and serious concern at the number of crime movies being produced by Hollywood. Many years later, after the Cahiers de Cinema guys named these productions film noir, Those very movies would become treasured parts of cinema history, but at the time of their production, Australian censors thought they were dummies' guides to a life of crime. So the censors decided that the Australian cinema goers could exist solely on a diet of Rock Hudson and Doris Day comedies, Cecil B. DeMille biblical epics, and anything starring Audie Murphy, Jeff Chandler, Jock Mahoney, or Sabu. In the 1960s, things were changing. Films like Blow Up and Zabriskie Point were banned, possibly because the censors didn't understand them. Every year, Australian film festivals were clubbed like baby seals for wanting to screen French movies that didn't star Jacques Tati or Louis de Funès, and might have shown Brigitte Bardot's bum. Came the 1970s and things changed. Dozens of film festival foreign language movie buffs were getting mightily pissed off with the annual drubbing they were getting from the censors. These pioneering cinephiles were educated in private schools alongside people who were, at that stage, were in federal parliament. They also had mates who wrote for newspapers, and there was nothing a mid-20th century Australian newspaper journalist liked more than shit-stirring, unless it was beer, cigarettes, strippers and two-up games. So the government was lobbied with cogent rational arguments, and finally in 1971 the R certificate came out. Entry to an R certificate film was restricted to people over the age of 18. Strangely, it was a conservative government that created the R certificate thanks to a now revered politician called Don Chipp, who later racked off to create his own political party, the Australian Democrats, which later disintegrated in the late 2000s. The first movie to get an R certificate in Australia was Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller. In its wake came a flood of blaxploitation flicks, Roger Corman women in prison films, sweet little dubbed Swedish sex comedies, a decade or more of back-catalogued Hammer and Amicus horror movies, complete with Kensington gore, fake blood and heaving bosoms, and then local movies like The Adventures of Barry McKenzie and Alvin Purple. Without the R certificate, there would have been no Ausploitation movies. They needed that. They needed to take it to the edge, and the R certificate provided the ability to do that. At first, being in my mid-teens by this stage, I thought the R certificate was an egregious affront to my ability to see movies. It wasn't until at the age of 15 and feeling bold, I splashed Brute aftershave all over myself and tried to get in to see Jim Brown in Slaughter on a double feature with Martin Scorsese's Boxcar Bertha. So I fronted up to the cinema, put on a deep voice and said, "One please." The man in the ticket box didn't even look up from his newspaper when he sold me the ticket to Cinematic Freedom. After that, I went to R-rated movies whenever I liked. Television too was changing. Soap opera nudity was available 5 nights a week on shows like Number 96 and The Box, which also brought us the first positive portrayals of homosexuality on the small screen. People could say bloody, bum and ass without being castigated by anybody more influential than an alcoholic newspaper pundit or an attention-seeking church leader. It wasn't quite a golden age of Australian television, but it might well have been gold-plated. Then along came the 1980s, and Pandora's box appeared with an aperture to insert video cassettes. VHS and Betamax were the delivery systems we all wanted and had wanted for decades. Audiences were, for the first time, empowered to see a movie, if and when they wanted to, as long as the studio decided to release it. Had the VCR been available in the early 1900s, George Méliès would never have had to sell toys at a train station, and Scorsese would never have made Hugo. The public loved the idea of deciding when and where they could see a film, and having the technology to record television for later viewing. And we celebrated the freedom. The reason why we learned to program VCRs before the older people did was to enable the viewing of old films off late-night television without sleep deprivation. We learned to make two VCRs together with a counterintuitive set of cables so we could make copies of films for our friends. For the first time, we were able to share films and programs that we had already seen with family and friends who hadn't. Still took years for film distribution companies to cotton on to the idea that people wanted to buy and own copies of movies instead of just renting them. The thing that really triggered that here in Australia was warehouses that sold ex-rental tapes from bankrupt video stores were doing gangbuster business. Suddenly everyone from kids to grannies actually owned copies of movies for the first time. Nobody who didn't live through that revolution could fully appreciate how awesome it was. There were unexpected benefits too. It made gift-giving dead simple. No more socks and deodorant on Father's Day. Give the old man the dirty dozen and enter the dragon, and on Mother's Day you couldn't walk down a suburban street without hearing Doris Day singing Deadwood Stage from Calamity Jane. Whole subcultures emerged around this technological innovation. Small international cabals formed to swap copies of movies recorded off television. Everyone from wuxia buffs to erotica aficionados for fans of creamy, jala, policier, pinku, kaiju and peplum movies found each other through advertisements and letter columns and magazines and via fanzines. Communities began to coalesce around the idea that you could become knowledgeable about film genres without spending 2 weeks in another town at a film festival, or doing a university course on it, or travelling in ridiculous distances to see the bicycle themes in a dingy movie house where you could watch the cockroaches run across your shoes by the light coming from the seat numbers at the end of the aisle. Censorship became a speed bump we could avoid by knowing the back streets. Movie studios and distributors fought hard against VCRs and all of their descendant technologies. Piracy prevention technology called Macrovision was added to videotapes to make dubbed copies of movies unwatchable. In response to this, some smart techies then created small black boxes to strip Macrovision from the video stream. Eventually, VCRs were sold that strip Macrovision for you, but though this was never advertised as a feature of the product. Now, here we are now. We have movie studios that have their own spy agencies, con artists, shifty lawyers and strong-arm merchants to attempt to enforce copyright. These industries resemble nothing as much as J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI trying to enforce prohibition. We've now reached an age where stopping piracy of movies is like trying to stop neutrinos with a tennis racket. From holding all the cards and controlling access, the authorities now hold a pair of deuces and wear a shifty expression. Blossoming of movie availability has yielded unexpected benefits too. Without it, we wouldn't have had Quentin Tarantino, the video store clerk who made good, or the vast number of film festivals and rooftop cinemas and home theatres and HBO, and best of all, we have audiences who are cinematically literate. Our parents and grandparents saw two movies per week, a double feature on a Saturday night, maybe. As I write this, 25 days into a new year, I've already seen 40 movies from a dozen different countries. I've also read 2 e-books on cinema, listened to podcasts and read blogs about movies from my couch. I can access tens of thousands of films and television shows, both legally and illegally, and watch them when I want to on my TV, my computer, my phone or my tablet. I still love old cinemas and adore the few surviving drive-ins, but now I'm empowered by choice and I'm no longer at the whim of others. Technology gives options and new ways of sharing the passions we discover. The diaspora of cinema, the ability to make a feature film for less money than it costs to take a 2-week vacation, the gift of being able to talk globally about movies we love and hate have enriched our lives as film geeks. Which brings us to the next step. How do we know which movies we'd like when the choices are myriad and accessibility is all but instantaneous? Yeah, we're fond of certain actors and directors. There are franchises we follow. Knowledgeable friends are sources of reliable tips. In spite of all this, we've still been burnt by debacles like George Lucas's second Star Wars trilogy and Prometheus and pretty much anything Baz Luhrmann turns his hand to. My biggest passion, in a long list of them, is finding good but obscure movies. I like forgotten films that are interesting. Maybe they aren't perfect in this, but these smaller films are worth the time you spend watching them. I'm also passionate about older films, weird and forgotten movies that have their own charm. Half a decade ago, I started podcasting about this kind of cinema. Paleo Cinema found a niche at looking at older films that weren't on most people's radar. The criteria I used for talking about movies were fairly simple. At first, it was any movie before Star Wars. I later amended that to any film more than 20 years old at the time of recording the podcast. For the most part, they weren't big films that everybody knew about. But finally, the last criterion I had was that they had to be movies that I cared about for some reason. When I was that kid going to drive-ins and cinemas and staying up late to watch movies, if you had have told me that in my middle years, I'd be talking about it to people all over the planet in a room literally where I am literally surrounded with movies I own, I wouldn't have believed you. It would have been too good a thing to be true. But that's the case. I'm surrounded by thousands of movies as I talk about this. And looking back and trying to remember what it was like in those days and who I was and how I thought about things in those days, this is nothing short of miraculous. This is one of those bright futures that nobody talks about. Everybody talks about dystopian futures. nobody talks about futures that are really cool and empower people and give someone's interest as a child the chance to blossom into a large part of their life and a really passionate thing to share with other people. But that's what time has done, and that's what technology has done, and that's what the progress of people and that increasing march that the whole human race is doing towards increasing freedom. That's what that's done for me. And I always try to keep that perspective about things. I think it's something that I carry internalized as a personal history, and it's also something that I treasure. Okay, that's what I've got for the introduction to this mad project of doing a movie book. There are tons of movie books around. I don't even know why I'm trying, but I've got to kind of put out there my own viewpoint on this, and that's what I'm going to be doing. Most of the book's going to consist of reviews of things, some of which I've done on Paleo Cinema, some of which I haven't. But I'm going to enjoy writing them. I've committed myself to doing 1,000 words a day, and I will. And when that's finished, if indeed, or people tell me books are never finished, they're just released. When it's done, I'm going to look for a market for it and see what I can do with it. But that's the introduction, and that's where I'm going to be coming from in this project of mine that I've really got to get going. Well, I've got a feeling that the radio gig is going to be a decreased part of my life because of that change that they've made in the programming. So that then, I mean, I could have moped about it, which I did for about, I don't know, 12 hours. But what I'm doing now is looking for the next thing to do. And this feels like this is the next thing to do. And it's what I'm going to be doing. So I'll keep people updated on it. I won't release any more of it until it's all ready, because who's going to buy something they've already got? But there is a possibility of publishing it as an e-book or something like that. And it may take a year or more to get the project done, depending on how things go and how real life interrupts with the passions, as they inevitably do. But that's about it for this podcast. It started out just as a music podcast. Why do I keep saying movie when I mean music? Music podcast. But that's about it this time around. I'm going to do the feedback next, but I just thought I'd let you know that things are changing here, and I'm going to turn them into positive changes. I really do feel that I'm going to contribute something here, even if it isn't big. So anyway, I'll take a break now, and when I get back, it'll be the feedback.
Private Jones came in one night, full of cheer and very bright. He'd been out all day upon the spree. He bumped into Sergeant Smeck, put his arms around his neck, and in his ear he whispered tenderly,
"Kiss me goodnight, Sergeant Major. Tuck me in my little wooden bed. We all love you, Sergeant Major. When we hear you boring, surely don't forget to wake me in the morning and bring me round a nice hot cup of tea. Kiss me goodnight, Sergeant Major. Sergeant Major, be a mother to me.
Kiss me goodnight, Sergeant Major. Love me my poor plates of meat or sore. Oh, kiss me goodnight, Sergeant Major.
And don't forget to shut the blinking door. I want to dream of dear old Happy Hempstead. The bull and bush ain't off the place for me, cook lino. Kiss me goodnight, Sergeant Major. Sergeant Major, be a mother to me.
Thank you.
was Billy Cotton and his orchestra with Kiss Me Goodnight, Sergeant Major, for all of you World War II buffs. I didn't get any real feedback, which is all your fault, not mine. But I do have to thank Dave Brandt, who alerted me to the fact that episodes 99, 98 and 97 were missing from the RSS feed. I'll just read it out. It says, sorry to bother you about this, but I find that three paleo episodes can't be downloaded now, 99, 98 and 97. The other podcasts in the neighbourhood of the 90s are all there, so I don't know what it is. These three show a size of 0 kilobytes, so something's not right. The problem may be anywhere in your house or mine, so I don't know. Thank you for the Rod Taylor episode. I still haven't watched many films of his, but now I need to check out more of them. I saved the Time Machine off TCM a few years ago. Remember enjoying it, but I haven't yet archived it properly, so I need to find that DVR. Yeah, thanks, Dave, and thanks for alerting me to that. I'm going to have to watch the feed to see what's happening with it. And if anybody else has any problem with it, let me know. The other thing is, I've got to thank the people who gave me copies of the missing episodes, because my archive wasn't up to date. It is now, and I'm going to keep it up to date now, but I am sorry that that occurred. So the only thing is that I may be missing one more episode. If anybody's got 101, if anybody's got 101, let me know. And I'll arrange to get a copy of it off you. So I'm not sure what's happening there. I'm going to have to quiz the podcast hosting over at Podbean and just see. But hopefully it's nothing too serious. So anyway, that's about it for this time around. A very odd episode, mostly music, but with that really weird bit of my introduction to the book I'm writing. Let me know what you think of it, please. Cultguru@gmail.com. You can go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe over at Facebook. You can leave feedback on paleo-cinema.blogspot.com as well, because there's a little thing to tick so you can leave a voicemail. And I'll be back in 4 weeks' time with yet another episode. So take care of yourselves. Keep watching some good films. And you've got to mention, sorry. I don't know if I've mentioned this. I saw Django Unchained finally. Finally turned up here in Australia. And yeah, I liked it a lot. I think it's good Tarantino. I think it's very harsh and brutal in appropriate places. It's got some comedy in it. And it does hit all of the touch points of previous Django films, including the contribution of Franco Nero. And just seeing all of the little bits and pieces by various character actors. Michael Parks is in it, John Jarrett, Lee Horsley, people remember from Matt Houston on TV, is in it. Tons and tons of people are in it. And it's all a little bit of fun. Apparently the original cut Tarantino had was about 5 hours long. So we may be, when the Blu-ray and DVD come out, there may be a ton of extras on it, which is always good fun. But yeah, I recommend it. I liked it a lot. I think it's a really nice take on the Western genre. And I also think that it does remind people just how brutal and nasty and sadistic slavery was. You've got to remember, Tarantino wasn't born in California. He was born in South Carolina. So he, in one sense, he's a Southern boy. And I think this is his acknowledgement of that in some way. So if you haven't checked it out yet, do so. If you're a Tarantino fan, you probably already have. But I do recommend it highly. But having said that, I'm out of here, and I'll be back in 4 weeks.